Are you prepared to navigate the evolving mergers and acquisitions landscape? As we anticipate a recovery, high-growth companies must tackle the ever-present challenge of cultural and operational integration, all while keeping an eye on regulatory hurdles and economic uncertainties. In this episode of the Privately Speaking podcast series, host and private enterprise partner Erica Whitmore examines the current M&A landscape and discusses the importance of strategic planning and regulatory scrutiny with Braden Mark, partner in the KPMG Transaction Services practice.
All right. Well, Braden Mark, so excited to have you here today for the Privately Speaking podcast. And you and I go way back. I don't even want to say how many years, but a lot of years from the beginning of our career. So excited to have way back. Maybe that's saying how old we are, too. And I am technically older, so I'll take credit for that. But why don't you introduce yourself? You and I worked together in audit a long time ago, but you've done a lot of other things since then. So why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Erica. Super excited to be here. As you mentioned, I started a long time ago, early 2000s, in our audit practice here in Denver, and have been on a journey through KPMG for really the 20 years since then, including some time in Zurich, Switzerland, New York, and San Francisco, and then back to Denver for the last 10 years. And really, for the past 15 plus years, I've been in our M&A transaction advisory practice. So I lead that practice here in Denver and hold a lot of other roles nationally within our deal advisory group. So every day of my life is M&A. So excited to talk about the topic here.
Well, that's why I wanted to have you on, because I every time I see you, I always have to bend your ear on, okay, what's going on? What are you hearing? What are you seeing? And so I'm glad we finally got you on the podcast so you could share that with the world, or at least the world of our listeners. So appreciate you taking the time. And maybe one thing we'll start out with, and I think a lot of our listeners are definitely, you know, the private side of the world, but I do think everyone's also a little interested in public, right? It's our markets. It's what everybody sees every day, or at least me when I watch CNBC every day. But why don't you give us, and I know this can change tomorrow, and so full disclosure, everyone, it does take us a little time to get this podcast out. So Braden could be wrong tomorrow. But what are you kind of seeing in terms of an update from an M&A perspective for public and private?
Yeah, so the M&A market is very volatile. It's the best word that I can use right now to describe what's going on. And just, I mean, like a little bit of context, the M&A market post the recession was on a pretty steady incline and really robust year over year growth all the way until 2020. And then we had a big pause for 4 or 5 months during the beginning of the COVID pandemic, followed by a boom that lasted approximately 2 years. So all the way into 2022. And it depends on how you define M&A. So I'll broadly just say, we're going to talk about M&A, including venture-sponsored investment, true kind of mergers and acquisitions type of activity, and then this nasty invention that popped up about 6 years ago called a SPAC.
That's what everybody who comes on says, some version of nasty.
It's a four-letter word, or in this case, acronym. And I think a lot of people think about it in that way. So, but in 2021, 2022, we really saw a massive increase in overall M&A or capital flow into companies in different stages of monetization or recapitalization. After 2022, so the last 2 years, and there's all kinds of driving factors. We can talk about those that kind of led us to where we're at today, but we saw a massive decline. So. Right. Overall global M&A volume in 2021 was close to $6 trillion. In 2024, closer to just over three. So really approximately half of what we were seeing just 2 years ago. So 2024, though, we started to see a recovery.
Right.
In the fall, I did a lot of, sort of conversations, speaking engagements on this topic and where we were thinking 2025 was going to go. And to your point earlier about making predictions and being very risky.
Yeah.
At that time, I said, we just need certainty.
Yes.
In the broader economic environment that we live in, which is really the crux of what allows M&A to happen.
Right.
And once we were able to achieve certainty, then the M&A market should open up. And we can talk about all those factors, but in the first quarter of 2025, there was significantly more certainty. And we actually even saw it at the end of 2024, where M&A deals started to spin back up.
Right.
So Q1 of this year was actually a great year. Really good year-over-year growth.
From 24 to 25.
24 to 25, same okay. quarter information or same quarter results. And so it was really good. And then Liberation Day happened on April 2nd. And along with all sorts of other aspects of the world, the M&A market, came to kind of a crashing halt. And that's not to say that everything has stopped. There are pockets of the M&A market where we still see robust activity, but broadly speaking, a really sharp decline and a lot of deals getting paused or pulled off the table. Until again, this idea of certainty kind of rises up again, and we can have an increased amount of certainty, which is just, it's paramount to being able to do deals.
Yeah,
so I'll stop.
You've got to be able to forecast. You've got to understand what are all the impacts, at least as of today, instead of a lot of volatility, like you said earlier.
Yeah, that's right. And it doesn't matter if you're a private equity investor or a corporate or what we call a strategic investor. They're both susceptible to the same risks when it comes to modeling.
Right.
And if you can't model with some level of certainty, your valuation gap is just too wide to be able to come to
get
any sort of conviction of what you want to pay.
Right.
And so bid-ask spreads in a world of increased certainty start to narrow. We can get deals done. They start to widen, which is what's happened in the last month or so.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to marry this podcast with one that I did not too long ago with NASDAQ, where we did talk about the public markets and we were wrong.
Mm, cool.
We were dead wrong. But but at that time, what the sentiment was, and this was a couple months ago, Braden, but what the sentiment was that at least for the IPO market, that there were signs that if we could get some of the certainty that you're talking about, that perhaps because the pipeline is so large for these companies that would like to go public, they were thinking second half of 2025. My guess is if they were on today, maybe they'd push into 26. But any view, again, more from the M&A angle, like if we do get some certainty here in the next, month, I think is what we're hoping. What do you think? And I know I'm totally jumping to the last question now, but I think it's kind of timely.
Yeah. I'm an optimist. So
me too.
I predicted 2025 was going to be a great year. I still think it's going to be a good year.
Yeah.
It's to be honest, it's not another 30 days. I think it's 60 to 90 days that we need for the dust to settle. And and some of the risk to be taken out of the system before the engine kind of starts back up. So late summer, I think, is sort of a good timeline to think about, the market starting to get going again. And I do think that there's good dynamics overall to get deals done. And there's a lot of other driving forces as to why certain types of deals just have to get done soon.
So tell me a little, can we dig into that a little bit, Braden? Because I think you're right, but I'd like to kind of tell our listeners, like, give me some examples, right?
Yeah. So there's two things that we see going on right now that I think will drive a lot of this. So one is private equity. So private equity is sitting on, depending on, you know, the stats that you look at, approximately $4 trillion of investments.
Right.
There is a enormous amount of investments sitting in private equity funds that have already outlived their yep. normal time horizon. So right. do you think about the amount of money that was invested in sort of 2016, 17, 18, those in the normal course of a private equity cycle would have already been monetized right. or divested. And there's just a significant number of those companies that are still sitting in funds. And if you look back historically, there's two driving forces. One is that ROI for a private equity firm is likely to just decrease the longer they hold a company. And so that's going to force them to divest sooner, along with, well, maybe there's three things. So that along with the fact that they can't go raise another fund, or they're going to have a very challenging time raising another fund if they don't return some capital to their limited partners. So it's the same pool of LPs that you want to go back to, and you're asking for more money when you haven't returned any capital on your last fund. So there's sort of that dynamic that exists that's driving that. And then on the private company side, one of the things that's really interesting is that we're seeing, you know, we went through a period of time of diversification of companies. And so you look back to...
Do you mean within funds, Braden? Do you mean like within funds that like they're investing in, or do you mean within the companies themselves, or both?
No, I just mean private public companies, not private yeah. equity owned. So just companies. And so if you look back at the S&P 500 in 2015, 35% of S&P 500 companies had business units with more than one SIC code. So they were operating in different types of business.
Right.
Today, that's down to 24%. And so we continue to see this trend of de-diversification.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, I think that there's more of that to come. There are more companies that need and want to sell certain business units that are no longer core.
Yeah.
And somebody else is a better owner for it. And
right.
so between private equity needing to sell because of the aging of their assets, and this idea of private or public companies, strategics, wanting to de-diversify and then use that capital for some other initiative, I think those are two driving forces that'll really help the markets, irrespective of the other noise.
Yeah, no, that's actually really helpful context. And I had not thought about it that way. That makes a lot of sense. You're right. There are a lot of companies that are much more laser focused these days. Other than AI, that has to be part of everybody's story, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, let's talk for just a few minutes on this, because this isn't going to be as fun as the next topic. But maybe if you could touch on legal and regulatory issues that companies that are looking to do M&A could come across. And you know, I would say a lot of times it's really good to hear war stories. So if you've got any in your war chest that you can share, like here's an example of what you shouldn't do, obviously without, you know, naming names, but would love to hear your views on just kind of the legal and regulatory landscape and how that could go wrong.
Yeah, so the regulatory landscape right now is one of the uncertainties that we're living in, because new administration, I think most people, because of the first Trump administration, can kind of handicap generally where things
right.
are going. But, you know, a couple of the big things. that are out there. So one is deregulation. Deregulation in any sense is going to help M&A because it makes companies and the attractiveness and profitability of a business and the prospects of a business a lot easier to get your arms around if there's less regulation. Now, we may only have this for 3 years before it all gets unwound. So, you know, do that calculus. But and then the other big one on the regulatory side, we're not going to talk about tariffs, are we?
No,
we can talk about tariffs, but
You can if you want. It's totally up to you. That's your decision.
we can touch on it, but you know, the other thing is taxes. So tax policy as part of regulation, and what happens later this year with regards to the 2017 tax policies, and whether those get extended, they change a little bit. I think generally speaking, most people think it'll be positive. They're not going to go away, at least in its entirety. And so that's a positive regulatory thing. Now, on the flip side, you know, there's other legal and regulatory things going on with antitrust and foreign investment in particular.
Right.
And this administration is actually, you know, while suggesting they're pro-business, are much more challenging to deal with on both of those issues. So less likely to approve deals where there's a foreign investor buying a U.S. company. And again, that could be a corporation or it could be private funds and getting through the CFIUS process. And then the other is antitrust. And you know, I mean, you read all kinds of news about companies in the tech industry in particular that, you know, the administration wants to break up because they think they already have too much of a monopoly. And so getting deals done, not just in that industry, but in others where there's a threat of, you know, either real or perceived antitrust issues are going to be really, really challenging. So, you know, we worked on a deal and spent a ton of time on it at the end of last year, and it's still hung up and waiting to see, you know, if we can get through HSA. So, so we'll see. But those are not being a legal or regulatory specialist day to day. Those are kind of the key things that we're keeping an eye on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I am going to throw a curveball at you. If you're okay with that, if it's not a great answer, we'll cut it.
When I was in high school, I had to quit baseball because I couldn't hit curveballs. So we'll see how this goes.
Hopefully that's not the case in your professional career. So what is the longest deal that you ever worked on that actually got done, and what was the hangup?
Oh man. So this is a really interesting one. This is probably 13 or 15 years ago. And
so it would have been one of your first ones.
It was earlier in my M&A time. Yeah. I was probably only 3-4 years in. And so we were looking at working for a private equity fund, one of the kind of five bulge brackets, big PE funds. And they were looking to do a take private of a public company, and I won't mention the industry just to keep innocent people safe. But it was a very complex deal to begin with. Any take private is you know can be very complex to begin with. But just the diligence and the negotiation period took about 6 months, just as a starting point.
Okay.
And the last 2 months of our diligence, we found some fraud.
Ooh, in a public company.
In a public company.
Oh, yeah.
So, financial statement issues, but also some other legal issues from a fraud standpoint, and what was being communicated in public filings and other venues to investors.
Wow.
And so it took another year for that legal process to unwind, which we were a part of. We have a great forensics practice that was deeply involved in the investigation. But, you know, it took a year for all of that to sort itself out before we could transact and, you know, our client be comfortable that they weren't going to be held, you know, carrying the bag at the end of the day. So,
Interesting. I'm surprised it didn't kill the deal. So it was important enough to go through the process.
Yeah. And quite honestly, we got a price reduction. So,
well, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Oh, I always like those zingers. Those are good ones. So real quick, we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about cultural and operational integration. So I think this is something I'm an audit partner, so that I'm not playing in my space right now, but every acquisition that I've ever seen, nobody ever gives enough attention to the culture aspect, and literally it can like spin the whole thing out of control. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, a lot of people don't give enough time and attention to both culture and just generally integrating the businesses. So, you know, in the M&A world, we sort of have this funny thing where everybody, you know, celebrates and congratulates each other when the deal signs or the deal closes. You know, like we just did this really big thing. Well, you know, any dummy can go buy a business, right? If you pay enough money, like you'll get a deal done. And then we joke like, oh, but now the real work begins.
Right.
I truly believe that. It's not that it's not hard work to execute the deal and get the deal done and closed. But the real work that drives value is always really hopefully or ideally in the first year after you close the deal. Because the reality is that if you don't achieve your integration, your synergies, and your cultural plan in the first year, it doesn't get done. And then you're just sort of left in perpetuity with two businesses that, you know, are imperfectly integrated. So, you know, I mean, people should be spending more time even pre-closing to plan those things out and really have a detailed integration plan, in order to succeed. And most people either wait until the deal's closed to really think about it, or they never really think about it. So that you know has an impact on the value of your return on doing the transaction. So
just from what you've seen, maybe some best practices that you've seen, what are some tips that you could give our listeners that, you know, here are some of the things you need to consider. Like to your point, Brayden, like as you're getting the deal done, like here's some things you guys like all need to get aligned on so that there is a chance for success, you know, kind of going forward and it is part of the plan and it's thoughtful, et cetera.
Yeah. So we use the term target operating model, and, you know, that work really has to be done, like I said, before you close the deal. And so target operating model is you fast forward the 12 months post closing, and what does the business look like on a combined basis, operating as one company? And so you have to really think about that. It's a financial exercise, but it's really driven by people, processes, footprint, in some cases, you know, where you're operating, how you're operating, you're doing different activities in different places. What that looks like, IT systems. Those are sort of the big ones, that people really need to nail and have a plan. So you have to have your model. And then the other thing is, at a minimum, you need an integration plan of like, what are you going to do day one? And we're going to talk about the cultural and the people stuff because day one is the most important day. But certainly also the first 30 days. So you may not do all the integration stuff right away, but you need to have a plan as to how you're going to execute it in the first 30 days or start to execute it in the first 30 days. So that's best practice in just sort of thinking through what you need to do. I'll go back to day one. So the most important thing that you can do on day one is communications.
Yeah.
And too many people overlook it. And, you know, I think it's like people get wrapped up in just sort of the chaos of doing
the
M&A.
Process. Yeah.
It's very tactical. You're trying to get to a finish line, close the deal. And a lot of folks they forget about the human side of it and taking themselves out of either the deal team or the executive team and putting yourselves in the shoes of, in particular, the employees of a company that's being acquired.
Yeah.
And what this means for them and what their psychology is when this is happening. And it's a very unsettling time for these people. Right. And so they need to hear from leadership of both their existing company and the new company or the acquirer to help settle them down and make them feel comfortable that, you know, this is going to be great for them. It's not just a business deal. It's also going to be good for them personally. And it can come in all ways, shapes, and forms as to how that gets done, but it's critically important in order to start to build an integrated culture, because if you don't get off on the right foot, it becomes very hard down the line to take what could be two different cultures, in some cases very different cultures, and trying to get them to merge and behave in one coalesced sort of manner.
Right. Well, and don't you think too, even if some of the goals of that, I don't know if I'm going to use the phrase like you did you say future? What did you call the model?
Target operating.
I mean, even if there's going to be synergies and that means some people's jobs are at risk, I mean, you talk about that, right? And you talk about at least high level what the process is going to look like and the timing as you know it today, so that you're being transparent and that at least everyone knows, right?
Yeah. Transparency is never loses.
Yeah, that's right. Totally agree. Well, so Braden, I knew this was going to go super fast and it has. So, but I want, if you had, okay, you know, here are my 3 to 5 parting thoughts. What would you want the audience to kind of take away from, and maybe touch just a little bit on your predictions one more time, just because I want it out there so that we know if we're wrong or right.
I would say this. So factors that are really, really important to what I believe is going to happen. So I'm going to stick with my prediction that by the end of the summer, things have calmed down. We're back to doing deals and it's going to be a good year. 2025.
It could even get crazy. If we really had certainty, right?
Yeah. So things I think that I'll then caveat a little bit with that have to be true. So, the debt markets are actually already pretty good.
Yeah.
A little bit of uncertainty right now in lending just because of the broader sort of economic environment. And so, you know, like if I'm a lender and somebody says, hey, can you commit to, you know, $500 million, you know, of debt on this deal and we're going to close in 9 months. It's like, well, I might charge you 8%, I might charge you 12%, but I'm happy to commit to the $500 million. So, that's driven by the overall economic environment. So the debt markets have to resettle and open back up. Generally, they've been pretty good. Just to be clear, like we're not going to live in an environment where debt is free again, like it was 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
So, but that doesn't keep people from getting deals done. It's just, we need to know pricing and the cost of capital. So we need the cost of capital and the lending markets to settle down just a little bit. That's the least of I think probably my concerns. The tariff stuff, I said I wasn't going to really talk about it, but it's tariffs. And that impacts some deals for sure, because you can't model the cost of your supply chain or your goods or you know, what you're going to sell stuff for with this amount of uncertainty. And so there has to be some leveling out and finalization and settling of what's going on there. But more importantly, just like where we're going as an economy, you know, are we headed for some sort of a recessionary environment or not?
Right.
And I think 4 months ago, most people said there's a very, very low risk. And now, you know, I heard one of our large investment bank advisors the other day say we're looking at it's 50-50.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah.
You know, so I think that that has to sort of play itself out. And again, just understand where exactly we're going. And I think that will be very helpful as well to things settling down. So those are probably the two things, that I would say. And once that happens, irrespective of what tariffs, you know, are going to be pervasive, where the economy is going, deals will get done. There'll be winners and losers, but
but
deals will start to get done. I mean, any period of time where there's disruption creates opportunity. And so people who want to buy and want to be investors are going to find that opportunity, and they'll be winners that come out of it. So, you know, I think it'll start out with domestic service-based businesses.
Yeah.
So the more domestic, the less exposure to
the international
risks that exist. And then services are indirectly impacted by tariffs, but you know, we're not manufacturing stuff. So it's not as big of an issue as far as a direct impact. So I think the M&A market will come back starting with those types of businesses, technology included, notwithstanding, you know, components that are being sourced internationally, or at least some of the parts. And then the rest will follow, including manufacturing. But again, like if you're manufacturing in the United States and mostly selling in the United States, that might be a really great business to invest into right now.
It might be.
All other things, you know.
Yeah, right.
Being so disruptive. So
yeah, absolutely.
So that's my prediction. And
so I'm calling you September 20th. I'm going to call you on September 20th, and we're either going to go have a beer or we're not. Or maybe we will no matter what.
Yeah, we will have a beer either way.
Awesome. Well, Braden, I really appreciate you being on today. I miss working with you all the time, but at least I get to hang out with you once in a while, and really appreciate all your thoughts. And I know our listeners do too. And I'm starting to lose my voice, so perfect timing.
Right. Thanks again for having me.
Yeah. Thanks, Braden. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to KPMG's Privately Speaking podcast. And be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.